welcome to Stop the Presses here on the 3rd of February, 2020. Mark Anderson, your host, coming to you live. And my guest today is UK column editor and co-founder Mike Robinson. He was on the show, about a year ago or a little less, and so he's a return guest. And in the wake of January 31st, all the revelry and champagne popping and all that that went on in the UK, we're going to talk about Brexit in very real and maybe sobering terms. Nevertheless, we want to get to the bottom of how real it is and the good, the bad, the ugly, warts and all. Thanks for being with me, Mike.
That's a pleasure, Mark.
Great. Yeah, it's been a while. And this is something that RBN listeners maybe don't get full doses of. They don't often get clear, concise UK-based news unless they're reading The Guardian or something. And so the UK column, among the very few over there, certainly has a grasp and has always had a grasp on the realities of Brexit coming into it and during the earlier times, and of course over the 3.5 years that this has ensued. And Mike, I saw your broadcast in real time this morning. UK column news runs Monday, Wednesdays, Fridays from 7 to 8 a.m. Central. That's 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern in the States. 8 to 9 a.m. Eastern in the States and 1 p.m. local time in the UK, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, the same days as this show, Stop the Press, was on RBN. And just to start out here, you noted there this morning the divorce is done, but now they're focusing on the future relationship. What exactly happened on the 31st? What is the nature of it? So we can understand better here stateside what happened and what's to come.
Well, this is really the key point of the whole Brexit thing, because what they decided as soon as the referendum vote was in was that they would split the process in two and that they would have a divorce, and there was an agreement around that divorce. And then they would, following the divorce, negotiate the terms of the future relationship. And there was a political declaration and a framework for those negotiations agreed to as part of the originally the Theresa May deal. And then since then, the Boris Johnson deal. There were some fairly minor changes between those two. But basically, what this allows them to do is to say that Brexit has been done on the 31st of January, and now they start the process of working out what our relationship is going to be with the European Union in the future. And so they are focusing as the main area of attraction for the general public on a free trade agreement. And then the question is, to what degree do we then opt back into EU institutions after that? Now, what's interesting about this is that back in 2015, David Cameron was touring all the EU leaders. And at the end of that tour, which took about a year or so, he arrived back. This was in January, February 2016, just as he was announcing the referendum. He arrived back in the UK with an agreement between Britain and the rest of the EU to change Britain's relationship with the EU. If he had won the referendum, then it would have been that deal which would have defined our future relationship with the EU. But, of course, he didn't win the referendum. The Brexit side won the referendum. And so now we're in a position where we start a negotiation again, it seems, to discover what that future relationship is going to be. But the question is, how much of what David Cameron had negotiated in 2015 are they going to rely on? Because, you know, nobody really, under normal circumstances, you would not expect to be able to negotiate and sign a trade agreement, a free trade agreement with the European Union or with any other country, for that matter, within a 12-month period. It's a practical impossibility. So they're going to have to, you know, there are certain advantages in the current situation, because up until this point, Britain remains fully aligned with all the EU regulations and all the EU rules. So that makes the process a little bit easier. But also the negotiation that happened before the Brexit referendum makes it easier as well.
So if you characterize this like a marital divorce, what happened on January 31? Was that the divorce being final, or was that the divorce going through another stage? And only at the end of this year, when all is said and done, will the divorce be final?
The divorce part of it is done. So the divorce is final. Then what happens is that we enter what they're describing as a transition period. But, you know, normally when you are transitioning, you're transitioning from something to something else.
Right.
At this point in time, we don't know what it is we're transitioning into because the negotiations haven't begun. Now, both Michel Barnier, who's the EU's negotiator for Brexit, and Boris Johnson both held live-streamed briefings this morning to set out their positions at the beginning of this negotiation. Barnier produced a document which is 20 or 30 pages long, and that document will go to the European Parliament on the 20th of February to be agreed on. I mean, it will be it'll be voted through, and after that, then the negotiations start in earnest. But at this point, there's no clear understanding of what we're transitioning to. But the other point to make is, of course, this is a 12-month period. Theoretically, the transition period ends on the 31st of December 2020, theoretically. But once again, just as with the divorce, there is the option to extend for up to a further 2 years. So this process could be going on for quite a long time.
It's almost like the divorce is final, but now they got to negotiate the assets, so to speak.
Well, no, I mean, the divorce is only final on paper because, in fact, as of the 1st of February, nothing changed in terms of farming rules or fishing rules or trade rules or customs rules, travel rules, immigration rules. Nothing changed. So at this point, nothing has changed. And until the future relationship is agreed, then nothing will change. Or if there is no agreement, of course, we could still leave at the end of the transition period with no agreement and no deal.
Okay, so therefore it is just on paper. The actual political and physical relationship has not changed. And until that does, you're in the same boat. You mentioned this morning in UK column that the fisheries, the waters of the UK are still open to the EU. If I understood you right, it was kind of early in the morning. I was having my coffee. It's always been the thing is that the EU fishing interests have always been allowed to get unusually and uncomfortably close to British shores. Isn't that correct?
Under the common fisheries policy, there were quotas, fishing quotas allocated to each EU country, but. EU countries, Spain, France, other fishing nations were able to enter UK waters to fish so long as they didn't exceed their EU quotas. And the Royal Navy, for example, would try to enforce that. But what the government announced last week was that Britain would become a sovereign territory for fishing. And this was one of the areas that today the mainstream press have jumped on as being areas of difference between the EU and the UK, because Michel Barnier in his presentation said very clearly that one of the prerequisites or the preconditions of a free trade deal between Britain and the EU would be that effectively access to British fishing waters would remain as they have been. Boris Johnson saying, well, that's a matter for negotiation, but Britain at this point is claiming that it's a sovereign territory with respect to the British waters, which is British waters extend to 200 miles from the coastline. So So this is one area that there is going to be some negotiation, but you have to be very, very careful about how you read and how you listen to what is being said on this, because really the key point that the government is making is that this is a matter of consent from the British side. And so, you know, although it seems that the UK is being quite forceful and hard on this particular topic and one or two others, in fact, I think everything is up for negotiation here, and there's nothing off the table at this point.
So everything's in a state of flux. The divorce is on paper only. Your basic relationship, as you've described, has not changed. Is that getting through to the majority of the British people, what you're telling me now?
Not really. I don't think there are too many people that understand. Because I mean, it's not surprising. There's been so much sort of chaos and noise over Brexit for the last 3 years that it's been really very difficult to follow and to understand. But of course, there's other policy areas that just aren't getting any coverage at all, defence being one of them. And so, you know, when the media isn't doing its job, then it's not really surprising that people aren't necessarily able to grasp exactly the nuances of it, because it's not that hard, but it should be explained properly by mainstream media, and they're not doing that.
Yeah, the news is in the nuances, I think, here. There's nuance there that I understand, and there's some that I'm just understanding now, or you're reminding me what I learned from you and others a couple years back. We're going to play Nigel Farage's speech to the European Parliament. I believe it was January 29th, 2 days before the big day. It's about 3.5 minutes. We might not go that long, but I want to get your comments. Let's go ahead and run that audio, please.
Thank you, Mr. Farage, for 4 minutes.
Thank you very much. So this is it, the final chapter, the end of the road, a 47-year political experiment that the British, frankly, have never been very happy with. My mother and father signed up to a common market, not to a political union, not to flags, anthems, presidents, and now you even want your own army. For me, it's been 27 years of campaigning and over 20 years here in this Parliament. I'm not particularly happy with the agreement we're being asked to vote on tonight, but Boris has been remarkably bold in the last few months, and Ms. von der Leyen, he's made it clear, he's promised us there'll be no level playing field. And on that basis, I wish him every success in the next round of negotiations, I really do. But the most significant point is this. What happens at 11 p.m. this Friday, the 31st of January, 2020, marks the point of no return. Once we've left, we are never coming back, and the rest, frankly, is detail. We're going, we will be gone. And that should be the summit of my own political ambitions. I walked in here, as I've said before, you all thought it was terribly funny. You stopped laughing in 2016. But my view has changed of Europe since I joined. In 2005, I saw the constitution that had been drafted by Giscard and others. I saw it rejected by the French in a referendum. I saw it rejected by the Dutch in a referendum. And I saw you in these institutions ignore them, bring it back as the Lisbon Treaty, and boast you could ram it through without there being referendums. Well, the Irish did have a vote and did say no and were forced to vote again. You're very good at making people vote again, but what we've proved is the British are too big to bully, thank goodness. So I became an outright opponent of the entire European project. I want Brexit to start a debate across the rest of Europe. What do we want from Europe? If we want trade, friendship, cooperation, reciprocity, we don't need a European Commission. We don't need a European Court. We don't need these institutions and all of this power. And I can promise you, both in UKIP and indeed in the Brexit Party. We love Europe. We just hate the European Union. It's as simple as that. So I'm hoping this begins the end of this project.
Mike, I wanted to cut off right there. I might not play the rest. That really encapsulates much of what I wanted to play. Has Nigel Farage mentioned often that comment, you even want your own army? Has he been one of the lone wolves in talking about that? Or is this among the first times, if not the first time, he might have mentioned that publicly in a broad, in a well-heard forum?
I think he has mentioned it a number of times over the years, but he hasn't really grasped that particular nettle until really at the run-up to the general election. And he and his colleague Anne Widdecombe, who's a former Tory party cabinet minister, Tory government cabinet minister, but she ran for the Brexit Party during the general election. They both absolutely got on top of the subject and understood it very well. And Anne Widdecombe gave an excellent briefing. And the video of that is on the front page of the UK Column website at the moment, if anybody wants to watch that. But she gave an excellent briefing of what the EU's defence union is about. Now, this is one of the really big questions for the UK at the moment, because the UK government is simply silent on this issue. Most MPs don't understand the issue. And those that even will engage with their constituents are relying on parliamentary briefing papers in order to answer their constituents. But this issue really exposes how they use language to mislead people. So, for example,
break, Mike, just so you know.
Sorry?
We got about 1 minute before the first break.
Okay. Well, look, Lord James of Blackheath, a member of the House of Lords, put in a question to the House of Lords, to the government, asking about EU Defence Union. Now, I'd like to explain the answer that he got from that and demonstrate how they use language to mislead people, because this is an extremely important point whenever we're looking at how the future relationship is going to develop. Defense okay.
I'll hold that a longer explanation till after the break that's coming up, and as the break comes up, I'll announce in the second half of the show I'm going to play me questioning Bilderberger and Economist editor Zanny Mitten-Beddoes about this very thing, military union, and we'll play that clip from a Chicago Global Affairs meeting after the bottom of the hour. But we're coming up on the break, and with that, Mike, right after this break, I'll have you give that explanation, because it's a really key point, as you're saying.
Yeah, okay.
At any rate, here we are with the break, and we'll be back after these messages. Stay tuned.
How would you like to earn an extra $10,000 or more a month from the comfort of your home? We show you how to win with a home-based business opportunity. This could be one of the best financial decisions you ever make. Work from home, full-time or part-time. Plus, you'll never have to talk to anyone. Our professional sales team closes all your sales for you, and you keep 70% of all the sales made. You could be earning money while you're sleeping, shopping, working out, wherever you are, day or night. Our system goes to work for you. You can make a great income without any special computer skills or sales training. Plus, you get paid fast, within just 24 to 48 hours after our professional sales team closes a sale for you. Let us help you eliminate your financial concerns. You could be earning enough money to pay off debt, buy a house, a car, or whatever the case may be. We've got you covered. If you'd like to add an extra extra $10,000 or more a month to your portfolio, and you would like to know exactly what we're doing and how we're doing it, go now to www.getstartedwithus.com. That's www.getstartedwithus.com. Again, that's www.getstartedwithus.com.
The reviews for Extendivite are amazing. Here are some from Amazon. By Christine, great for heart palpitations. By Anne, before I started using this product, every afternoon, my ankles and my hands would be swollen. That doesn't happen anymore. So if that part of their advertising is true, I have to assume that the rest of it is also. Not to mention that when I had my yearly blood test, only a few weeks after beginning to use this product, my cholesterol had dropped over 30 points. I'm going to continue to take it. By Croc, I love this product. It really works. By Brad, works great, thank you. Tell us your story. Get your Extendivite today. To order, call 1-877-928-8822. That's 1-877-928-8822. Or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
TalkRite, the conservative app offered by TalkStream Live that caters exclusively to the conservative talk radio community. Here you'll see only talk shows and podcasts from the conservative right, all the big broadcast names and online digital shows in one place. TalkRite makes it easy to find all your favorite conservative talkers with all the upscale features you come to expect from TalkStream Live. Keep up with the fast-paced political world. Download TalkRite today from Google Play or the App Store.
Hey, is that a new music app?
Yeah, check it out, Surfer Music Discovery. It links to thousands of online stations, but the twist is you see the song names and artists that are now playing live.
That's different. No guessing. Looks like a waterfall of music.
So many formats. Rock, oldies, country, R&B, jazz, and a whole lot more.
How's that spelled?
Surfer, S-U-R-F-R.
Is it expensive?
It's free. No need to sign up or sign in.
Get the Surfer Music app free from Google Play or the App Store.
This is your host, Mark Anderson, 3rd of February, 2020. My guest, Mike Robinson of ukcolumn.org. Mike, you wanted to go ahead and continue with that train of thought you had before the break. Go right ahead.
Right. So as I say, a member of the House of Lords, this Lord James of Blackheath, asked a question of the government. And the Defence Minister, Baroness Goldie, replied to his question. And her first sentence said, "The UK has no agreement with the EU about British participation in the establishment of a European Defence Union." Of course, that statement is absolutely correct as far as it goes. But what Baroness Goldie did not say, so she's effectively lying by omission here. She did not make the point that Britain is part of an institution called the European Intervention Initiative. And this was something that Britain was a founding member of. It was established in 2017. And it has 10 European countries as members, including the UK. And it is not an EU institution. It's separate from that. It's a multilateral agreement with EU member states and the UK. And so when she said that the UK has no agreement with the EU, of course, that's absolutely correct. But that doesn't mean that the UK isn't doing anything to help establish a European Defence Union, because they are. And so, for example, in the documentation that goes alongside the European Intervention Initiative, it says quite clearly that EI2 intends to contribute to the ongoing efforts within the European Union to deepen defence cooperation, notably PESCO. And PESCO is one of the main pillars of European Defence Union. You've got to be very careful whenever the government is commenting on what is possibly going to be what aspects of the future relationship with the EU that are going to be negotiated. You've got to read the language very, very carefully. You've got to read between the lines, and you've got to understand some of the other agreements, which are not necessarily EU agreements, but which feed into our relationship with the EU. So it can be quite a complex situation. But the truth is that Baroness Goldie's reply to Lord James was at the very least lying by omission, because she didn't divulge pretty key information and suggesting that Britain has no involvement in the development of defence union was absolutely untrue.
And then the next question is, what are the implications of this for Brexit?
Well, look, this comes back to what the UK column was saying from the very beginning of the Brexit process, Mark. We didn't really understand and still don't understand the difference between the position that David Cameron had in 2015, which was to be a member of the European Union, a reformed European Union, but a member of the EU nonetheless. And then Cameron's position was that Britain would opt out to institutions that it didn't want to be part of. And Theresa May and Boris Johnson's position 4 years later, or 5 years later, which is we are out of the European Union following Brexit, and we will then opt back into the institutions that we do want to be part of. We're not. It's very difficult to see how, at the end of the day, those two situations are any different at all. So although they're talking about a Canada-style free trade agreement, there are other negotiations going on, defence being one area, security as well, other policy areas where they are wanting to come up with agreements. And each of those agreements will tie us into obligations, which are, you know, part of the problem that has caused Brexit in the first place.
Very interesting. So you could have been in the EU and opted to get out of whichever parts you wanted to get out of, or you can be out of the EU and opt to get into whatever you want to get into.
Right. So that's right. So that's why they split the process in two. That's why they had the divorce. The divorce allows them to claim that we've left, but then the future relationship negotiations provides that opt-in. And so one of the very few comments that we've had from the British government on defence union, it talks about opting into, keep maintaining our sovereignty, but opting into. And of course, if you opt into EU institutions in that way, you don't maintain your sovereignty. That was that was the reason for the whole Brexit process in the first place, this loss of sovereignty.
Yeah, and that would explain, again, and I'm familiar with this from a few years back, being on UK column myself, having worked with you a little bit on this and corresponded, that would explain why Cameron, after he toured with all those European leaders in 2015 into early 2016, called the resulting document the best of both worlds.
Right. That's right.
My goodness, there's a real dialectic there. There's a major mechanism there for very, very broad-based deception, this linguistic deception that's inherent in this. I certainly hope there's, more honest minds will prevail. And we'll explore this more and listen to David Meadows a little bit after this break.
Simple smile, such platonic eye. How they drown in incomplete capacity. Strangers thought them all when the fear it calls. How we drown in stylistic audacity. Charge the common ground.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to AROutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AROutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AROutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. plus Magful clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath, head to aroutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at aroutfitting.com.
Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we have been building our online store. Well, we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country. Here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Welcome back to Stop the Presses. Your host, Mark Anderson, 3rd of February, 2020. And we're deciding today, ladies and gentlemen, whether we're going to have 2020 vision looking ahead at what's in store for the UK under Brexit, under the divorce agreement that so far appears to be mainly on paper. My guest is Mike Robinson of UKcolumn.org. Mike, what you just got done saying before we play the audio of Zanny Minton-Beddoes in Chicago is pretty sobering. It really shows the power of deceptive language and the way you can have this sort of revolving door set up that Cameron seems to have engineered. Maybe he wasn't solely responsible. He was trying to appease a wing of the conservatives at the time, right? And so he gave Brexit a little more leeway.
Well, that's right. And the Conservative Party has always had quite a strong Eurosceptic wing, and that has been growing in influence over the last few years. So, yes, his decision to hold the referendum, he had been promising it for a long time, but his decision to hold the referendum was really an effort to placate that part of his party. He didn't succeed in getting the outcome that he wanted to see. But at the end of the day, that is what has happened so far. And the question is, will those Eurosceptics, how closely will they be watching this process over the next 12 months? And another question is, how closely will Nigel Farage be watching this process over the next 12 months? Because it's really, at the end of the day, going to come down to him probably to raise the alarm if he feels that the negotiations are giving away too much or going in the wrong direction. And I think he needs to be talking a lot more about defense in the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, not just making quick references to the army. Yeah, I would agree, because this is such a key point, and it's where much of the deception lies. Let's go ahead and listen to Zanny Minton-Beddoes, the Economist editor and Bilderberg steering committee member. Bilderberg may have played a role in this, of course, back in 2013 when they met in the UK with Cameron there. That's a little bit speculative, but it certainly stands to reason. At any rate, here's Danny Mittenbettos answering a question by me at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, October 4, 2019, about 3 weeks before a former deadline, October 31st, that was cited as important for Brexit. So let's go ahead and listen to this exchange.
Program. I understand there exists a military union in the EU that Britain is a part of, or British military assets are a part of it, and that a lot of EU laws and regulations have been embedded in the British legal code. Is it possible that you could have a Brexit on paper, but everything is so inextricably wound together that it would never really all the way happen?
On the military side? Or I think there are some areas that you will want to maintain. Both sides will see it in their interest to maintain as close a links as possible. But the EU is a rules-based organization, and all of these links have been built up on the basis of us being a member state of the EU, as a result of which certain legal obligations and rights come. If we're no longer a member, then, you know, that is ended. And so we have to kind of rebuild those links. And that will take an enormous amount of time. And how easily it's done depends on whether there is willingness to negotiate that and willingness to work on it on both sides. And that, in turn, I think, depends on the terms of our departure. So if we have a negotiated withdrawal where this is done over, you know, many years, and there's a transition period, and all the things that were in the withdrawal agreement that Theresa May negotiated, or and could be indeed if there's an agreement made with Boris Johnson now, then I think this stuff becomes, you know, the work of many bureaucratic hours, but that's really what it becomes. The problem with us flouncing out, the kind of crash-out scenario, is that just from a legal perspective, thousands of things that were automatically part of UK law because we were a member of the EU and vice versa just doesn't hold overnight. And so it's going to happen in an environment of mutual recrimination and anger. And then I think that's when you have the dislocation in the short term, but also the political difficulty of rebuilding this stuff. So you're right. Many areas, we will want to maintain those links, and the Europeans will also want to maintain those links, but they will have to be rebuilt because we will. It's a very legalistic organization, the European Union. I mean, it follows rules, and if you're not a member state, you'll treat it in a very different way than if you are a member state. And if that happens overnight, from the 31st of October to November the 3rd or 1st or the end of January to the beginning of February, it's just. I think this is easily forgotten. There's the sort of the laws that were apt one day will no longer be applicable the next day, and you can have temporary extensions and you can have this and that, but there's all kinds of things that have to be put in place that haven't yet been put in place.
Yeah, right here, please, Lisa.
Okay, that's the end of that. Mike, what's your reaction to that? Her remark, this could take many years, jumps out, but it's not the only thing. And I'll note for the audience that this is the first time Mike has heard this, so we're getting an unvarnished, fresh response to this. Nothing rehearsed here. Go ahead, Mike.
Well, I mean, the first observation is that she didn't want to answer your question directly. And okay, she was talking about the possibility of us crashing out with a no deal, which was a possibility at that time. but nonetheless, she wasn't necessarily answering your question directly, but even so, what she said was quite clearly that, you know, the UK and the EU would want to be very close in this area. And her point about it taking a long time, this is what I was saying earlier, when many, many commentators saying that a year is not sufficient to develop the future relationship with the EU. But the advantage that Britain has compared to other countries is that, you know, whenever we left on the 31st of January, and I think of the word left in inverted commas, because on that day then, the entire body of EU law was placed on the British statute book. So up until that point, as she said in her statement there, the rules and the laws associated with membership of the EU were presumed because we were members of the EU. But as part of the divorce agreement, all that ends up as a block on the British statute books. So it's now British law. So we are on the day of the divorce. And you, again, you may ask yourself, how is this a divorce? But on the day of the divorce, we remain absolutely 100% in sync with the EU with respect to our rules and laws and our regulations. Now, what might happen in the coming months is that there, in some areas, might be some divergence in those rules. For example, the British government has already announced that it would not be implementing Article 13 of the Copyright Directive, which is the new rule that the EU is pursuing, which says that social media companies and other internet companies have to provide a real-time filter on a material which is being uploaded to their platforms on the internet. It's very similar to YouTube's content ID, but they want this rolled out across right across every possible social media platform and other internet platforms. The EU wants that. Now, the UK has already said that it's not going to implement that. So there's one area where there's going to be some slight divergence in what the UK is doing and what the EU is doing. But the UK is pursuing what it's describing as online harms legislation. And last year it published online harms white paper, which where they listed the dangers of the internet as far as they were concerned. And while they talked about the potential dangers for children and the use of the internet, one of the two of the really big areas where they want to deal with online harms is disinformation, as they called it, and censorship. This is a key policy area for them. So while at this point they say that they are opting out of, and there's going to be divergence on this issue of the copyright directive from the EU, until we see the legislation, which is going to be placed in, before Parliament in the summer or around the summertime, on this online harms policy area, we don't know exactly whether there's going to be any divergence. So we just have to wait and see. So, you know, she is right in much of what she says. The EU is a rules-based organisation. And how this future relationship builds and what the common rules are going to be as we move forward remain to be seen. But we are absolutely going to be opting into many of the major EU institutions.
My goodness. So, I mean, you could look at that down either end of the telescope. I mean, at first it sounded to me like the divorce signified the wholesale integration of EU regs into the British law to where you no longer call them EU regs. It's just British law.
That's right.
And then it's just a question of which parts of it you don't want to be in.
Well, no. What will happen from this point forward is that theoretically, since we have left, in inverted commas, theoretically what happens is that Parliament then has the right to decide what future direction British law takes, which may or may not be in parallel with what the EU does. So you know, this is us reclaiming our sovereignty because we are now able to decide for ourselves what direction we go forward in. But until there's a trade deal done and until the other policy areas that we want to be closely aligned to the EU in are understood and agreed, that there can be no major divergence between the EU's rules and the UK law, because as soon as you know, if you imagine negotiating a trade deal, which is going to take at least 12 months, but might take longer, so there's the opportunity to extend.
Right.
If Britain introduces laws which take us away from the EU in terms of regulations and rules and law, then as you move down the months, March, April, May, if that diversion starts to happen, then that aiming for a trade deal becomes a moving target. So how do you can never reach an agreement unless you have absolute parity between both sides. So until that trade deal is done and everything is understood, it's a practical impossibility for the UK to diverge from EU rules and regulations without the EU's agreement. And of course, if you're going cap in hand to the EU to ask for permission to do X, Y, and Z, then how is that a sovereign decision?
Absolutely. So the trade deal is the real linchpin here.
Well, that and defence and a couple of other policy, security and a couple of other policy areas, there are a number of areas that are really key to how much sovereignty Britain actually has as a result of this.
Very interesting. That is a very tricky situation. I mean, the average Brit or average American not getting the right kind of information would never see these nuances. These complexities that have to go a certain way. So based on what you just said, having a negotiated, detailed exit, presumably, so Britain can chart its own course, would be better than just crashing out?
Well, it's better than crashing out in the sense that if we had, as she said in her reply to you, she was extremely concerned about the possibility of Britain crashing out at the end of the process. At that time, she was talking about the 31st of October or the end of January. Now, and as she said, if we had left on that basis, then theoretically the body of EU law would not have been placed on the British statute books. So businesses, service industries would have found it very difficult to be able to understand what rules they would be operating under on the 1st of February. That would have been quite hard for people. There was talk in October of falling back onto World Trade Organization rules and regulations. But even that would have been pretty tricky for people because suddenly there would be customs regulations that they hadn't any experience of. I mean, most people don't remember the last time they had to deal with a customs process to export a good or a service into the European Union. So, trying to make that switch overnight would have been tricky for people, although some hold the view that at the end of the day would have been the best outcome. Despite the short-term or even medium-term pain of that process. But, you know, what we have now is that the rules didn't change on the 1st of February and they aren't going to change until the 31st of December at the earliest. They may not change for up to 2 years after that. And really, other than that, all bets are off because we don't know what the rules are going to change into after those dates anyway. And there's still the opportunity at the end of that process that no agreement could be reached and we could be basically leaving with a no-deal situation.
At that point in time, would a no-deal situation work?
Well, you know, if you've got no deal, you've got no deal. You've got to make it work. It doesn't really matter. It's not going to be an ideal situation. At least a lot of people would view that as being far from ideal, but we would fall back onto World Trade Organization rules and continue trading on that basis. People would suffer some short-term discomfort as they tried to work out how the heck they were going to continue to do business. But, you know, it would be resolved. And, of course, when you put yourself in a sort of crisis situation like that, there's a lot of motivation to resolve it pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean, knowing that default is there, that the WTO rules, just speaking perhaps as a somewhat naive American on this subject, that would seem to be maybe painful and confusing, but maybe that pain and confusion wouldn't last very long, and at least there's a net to catch you.
Well, Look, Mark, you know, that is a question that I don't think there are very many people know the answer to. It's certainly a question that there was a lot of angst and anger from both sides of the argument in the run up to the divorce agreement being done, because there was a risk, a perceived risk that we would leave without a deal. And lots of people expressing lots of concerns on both sides of the argument over that. So, you know, there is no way of knowing just exactly how long the pain would last for. It might be a year, it might be 10 years. You just don't know until you try to go down that road. But, you know, I honestly don't think there's much, although it is a theoretical possibility, I don't think there's much chance of that at this stage. I think the EU and the UK are going to find a way forward, possibly not to the satisfaction of people that thought that we were actually leaving, because I think we're going to find ourselves, as we've said for the last few years, I think we're going to find ourselves tied into rules and regulations that really we wanted to get out of. I mean, for just one example, Barnier, when he was talking about the proposed trade deal this morning, was talking about dispute resolution, and you know, one of the key areas that Britain wanted out of in the Brexit process was out from under the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice.
Right.
Well, the European Court of Justice is the final arbiter for trade disputes at the moment. So, what is this body that's going to be the arbiter of trade disputes in the UK EU trade deal? It's likely to be that organisation, and is that something that people were who voted for Brexit will be happy with? I don't think so.
Yes, it seems like you're walking through a door and you're going down a hallway, and it says exit above the door, and you open that door, and there's another hallway and another set of doors, and you're wondering how you can get out, or where's the end of this building, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, very tricky, you know. Interestingly, the New York Times, or New Pork Times, sometimes they call it, they kind of gave the counterpoint to Farage in their reporting. You know, Farage made this sound pretty rosy, as we heard. And, you know, we're proud Britons. You know, we're tired of being bullied. You can't, you know, we're going to wave our flags inside the European Parliament, even though that's against the rules. That's how his speech ended on the 29th of January. They were waving the flags. And you know, he's pretty much saying happy days are here again. And there's going to be some bumps in the road, but, you know, Britain will prevail. And everybody likes that optimism. And he's a good speaker and all these things. And then the establishment press comes out and they're just quoting the Marshall Plan organization, the German Marshall Fund, that is, and the European Council on Foreign Relations. And they're saying things like Brexit is a defeat, a rebellion against the concept that working together makes Europeans stronger. And then the New York Times went on to say, at the same time, the shock of Brexit has produced a unity among the remaining 27 nations that is hard to find on any other issue. And so their narrative is almost the exact opposite of Farage. Farage is saying, you know, this Brexit can be part of a larger movement to dissolve the European Union. And the establishment press is saying Brexit is making the rest of the EU stronger than ever. But it's almost like those are two polarities that miss the reality of this.
I think that sounds like they're protesting a bit too much there. I think there's no question that. People with a more globalist viewpoint are pretty unhappy with this situation at the moment. I think there is a major risk that Britain's exit, particularly if it ends up being successful, could provide energy to some of the other exit groups. So there is a Frexit group within France. There's certainly a lot of Euroscepticism in Poland. and some of the other Eastern European countries. So, you know, there are opportunities for those organizations that would want to promote the idea of nations leaving the EU to gain some ground. I'm not sure. I think whether they succeed at that very much depends on how well the UK does at the end of this process. And if they see that the UK has managed to leave the EU and not suffered too badly by it, in fact done very well out of it, then we might see a bit of momentum being built in those kinds of movements in other EU nations. But they're still relatively small organizations at this point, and don't have they don't have the momentum behind them at this stage to actually achieve a Frexit or a German exit. I don't think Germany would ever leave. I don't think the French government would ever contemplate leaving. But the French people, well, you know what's been going on in France in the last year or two.
Of course, yeah.
Yes.
Well, there's the Stop the Presses. You can check out UK Column News at ukcolumn.org, Monday, Wednesdays, Fridays, 1 p.m. UK time, from 8 to 9 p.m. Eastern and 8 to 9 a.m. Eastern, gosh darn it, and 7 to 8 a.m. Central. Thanks again, Mike.
My pleasure.
Okay, everyone, we'll have Patrick Henningsen of 21st Century Wire on here this coming Wednesday to talk about Julian Assange and other matters. We'll see everybody next time on Stop the Presses.
Like to earn an extra $10,000 or more a month from the comfort of your home. We show you how to win with a home-based business opportunity. This could be one of the best financial decisions you ever make. Work from home, full-time or part-time. Plus, you'll never have to talk to anyone. Our professional sales team closes all your sales for you, and you keep 70% of all the sales made. You could be earning money while you're sleeping, shopping, working out, wherever you are, day or night. Our system goes to work for you. You can make a great income without any special computer skills or sales training. Plus, you get paid fast, within just 24 to 48 hours after our professional sales team closes a sale for you. Let us help you eliminate your financial concerns. You could be earning enough money to pay off debt, buy a house, a car, or whatever the case may be. We've got you covered. If you'd like to add an extra $10,000 or more a month to your portfolio, and you would like to know exactly what we're doing and how we're doing it, go now to www.getstartedwithus.com. That's www.getstartedwithus.com. Again, that's www.getstartedwithus.com.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.